Accession number 30,002, Mr. Eric Harrison, Rio 6. Now, we're talking about this typical anti-submarine patrol, you know, 612 squadron. They say that the briefing, you'd sort out who was going to be, you know, on the Astrodome and, you know, the route. Anything else on the briefing? Or is that about it?
No, I don't think so.
So what would happen after the briefing?
Well, we would then get taken by...
Now, you'd have your flying kit on by then. Flying kit? It's almost underpants and socks up, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
What would you actually wear?
Well, I would have flying boots on, and I would have flying fur-lined leggings and a fur-lined jacket. I'd just have my forage cap. For that part of it, I was issued with silk gloves, which we never wore, but we did.
And why not?
Well, you know, there wasn't the need, really. I mean, as a navigator, I had to have my hands free for drawing up my chart, and silk gloves were an impediment to that, and we would have proper fur-lined gloves as well. But we all got the same kit, and Bomber Command were flying at 30,000 feet and was pretty cold up there if the heating wasn't working, whereas with us we would fly at about 3,000 feet and bomb at 50 feet. I mean, that's where it was at 50 feet we released the bombs. If
well, I mean, you weren't that desperately cold, even though it was November, December when you were the first time.
No.
Would you have a helmet? What was your helmet? Any oxygen?
I'd have a helmet, yes, I'd have a helmet.
And that would have an intercom connection?
And that would be for the intercom,
would
yeah.
Would you have oxygen, even though you weren't flying?
No.
So, you're in your flight kit, now you go to the aircraft. And what would happen when you took over your aircraft?
I mean,
what checks would you make?
Well, I would just check that the drift site was okay. I mean, I'd already signed for it as being okay anyway, but that was my first opportunity to check that it actually was okay. I'd be having a look at the compasses to see if they were okay. We had both the magnetic compasses and the gyro compasses. I had a navigation desk, and I'd just be wanting to see that was in top class condition. I mean, we were taking over from aircraftsmen that had done the job very seriously. You know, there was no question of signing something off. Just to get rid of us, we were going up on our operations, and if anything went wrong, and it happened to be due to carelessness on their part, there would be trouble for them. You know, they were in a military organisation, and there was a great friendship between ground crews. Generally speaking, a ground crews were assigned to a particular aircraft. But whether we got that aircraft or not, I don't know. I don't know how it was allocated. I should think it was just how it came along.
Did you have any sort of, I mean, were you friendly with the ground crew? Or?
As friendly as you could be with ground crews, because you didn't always get the same ground crew. The same ground crew was with the aircraft, but we didn't always get that particular aircraft. But we knew the ground crews, and our lives were in their hands, and they knew it. And when we did air tests, we did do air tests from time to time, after an aircraft had its regular DI inspection, and we would take them up. So they knew that, you know, if somebody that was looking after the engines is going to do the job right, because the pilot's going to say to him, right, we're doing an air test in a couple of hours' time, you can come up with me. And so they knew that they were going to fly in the aircraft that they'd service, you see. So So I mean that created a great responsibility and discipline.
Before you took off, were your crew superstitious, or were you superstitious?
Yeah,
you know?
Very much so. Yeah, very
tell us,
very
tell much.
Well, you would usually take something up that belonged to your girlfriend. In my case, my girlfriend then, and you know, something that she'd given you, maybe a cigarette case or something like that that she'd given you as a. And yeah, we had idiosyncrasies. You would wear the same reefer pullover on, you know, for operations and things like that. Really, I can't go into it in too great a detail because a lot of it's personal. But they were very superstitious.
And what was the takeoff procedure then, as far as you were concerned? You'd be going on. It would be a single aeroplane patrol, wouldn't it? You wouldn't be going with it.
No. We were just. We were just. You know, take up our positions, check up our various things. The laddie in the rear gun turret wanted to know if the turret rotated properly up and down and sideways, and that his seat was okay, and the door fastened behind him, and wireless operators would tune into base, probably. I don't know about that, because we couldn't break radio silence, but I don't think that would be too big a problem on the ground, because you know, the radio wave from 3,000 feet would go a lot further than it would on the ground. They'd probably just check up with the radio tower on the airbase and just make sure all the equipment was okay. We all fastened in for takeoff. We just got. We would do an air gun test when we took off. We would head for a small island where it wasn't inhabited, and we would fire around a few rounds with the guns, just to make sure that the guns were in working order. But I didn't really have very much to do in that respect.
What was the takeoff like in the Whitley?
Well, I don't know really. what was it like?
Just routine, I presume.
Yes, it was just a routine thing, really. You could, you know, we were all pretty relaxed on it. There was no tensions and things like that. we were going to work. There was no particular tensions.
And what would your role be once you'd taken up? Just tell us what your job was. Run through it for us.
Well, my first job would be to give the calculator course, knowing the wind speed and direction that was given to me by the Met officer. And we would get up to flying height and start our patrol from a designated point, which might have been John O'Groats, for instance. We'd start off from John O'Groats, and I knew the track that we were having to follow. So I would give the pilot a course which would take into account the wind speed and the any deviation there might be in the compass, which we'd calculated, you know, when we swung the compasses, we would be looking for a deviation in the compass and set up a chart, and we'd use that chart to adjust our air course, and at the first opportunity, I would try and find a wind, try and find what the real wind was, not the one that.
Tell me about that. How would you check the wind?
Met officer. Well, The easiest way to check it was by dropping a float. Dropping a float which had... what would it be? We used to do it in laboratories at school. Drop something in water and it lit. Can you remember what the element was?
Phosphorus, probably.
Phosphorus, yeah. It was a phosphorus float which would break open on hitting the water and it would light up. And we'd do a three-course wind on that, and that meant that we flew like that and took the deviation from the wind, and then we'd go that way. And the rear gunner did this for me. He would tell me what the drift was off his gun. He would line his gun up on it and tell me what the drift was. And we would draw a cocked hat, as they called it, which was just a triangle. Take the middle point of the triangle, and that was measure that from the centre, and you could tell where the wind was from. Couldn't.
So it's the speed and direction, I guess.
Yeah.
Anything else you have to do? You got to see, calculating the course, you're checking the wind speed and direction. What else are you doing, isn't it?
No, that was my time to go to sleep. Try to catch up with a bit of sleep.
So that was it?
Yeah, it was. I used to be. They often wondered how I navigated when I was on Sunderland. I said, you know, when you look round, he's always asleep. How did he do it? Because that was because I was airsick.
Were you still? So you'd sleep a lot on the aircraft?
No, not a lot, just a little bit.
And what about air sickness? Were you still getting airsick?
I was airsick the whole of the time I flew, until I got onto Liberators.
How bad were you? I mean, were you actually sick, or was it just a matter of feeling poorly?
No, I was very ill, yeah. I used to be very ill. I don't know whether this is the time to say it, but we did once get diverted to Plymouth. This was when I was at Pembroke Dock.
But it's just a continuing problem for you then?
I was never as sick as a pilot. Never. I was 60 hours as a pilot, and I was never as sick once. And I did loops and spins, and it was because there was no movement of the aircraft. I was part of it. You know, when I was part of it, there were no bumps because I was with the aircraft. Whereas a navigator, I would sit there and the aircraft would bump, and I would go up and the plane would come down, and that's what made me sick as a navigator.
Now, who would be watching the submarines?
We had radar.
Who was operating that?
And the wireless operators would operate the radar.
So the search would be made by radar, would it?
It was later on. It wasn't when I first started.
Right, well, that's where we are. How would you look for the submarine when you first started?
When I first started, we'd do it visually with glasses.
Now, who would be doing it?
Well, the pilot would be doing it for. The rear gunner would do it aft. And whoever was in the Astrodome would do it from the Astrodome. That would be either myself or the wireless operators.
So that would be going all the time to the area?
Yep, every minute somebody was on watch.
Now, I presume you wouldn't often see them at this time.
don't embarrass me.
No, but it's a big ocean and they're not very big.
That wasn't the real reason why we were flying. We could win the war by keeping the U-boats underground, under the water, sorry, not underground, but under the water. If a U-boat was on top and it was out of our visual range, and he was able to see us because he would have radar, and they had radar, I think, before we did. They would dive because they didn't want to be seen and to be challenged. His job wasn't to shoot aeroplanes down. His job was to sink ships. And so he would dive. Now, diving underwater, he had to use his batteries. And that only allowed them a certain amount of time at sea. If you could keep a U-boat underwater, he wouldn't get very far, because he had to come up and be on the top to recharge his batteries. And by recharging his batteries, he could stay at sea. So our purpose was to keep the U-boats underneath. If we got a chance to sink them, that was a bonus. So the aircraft squadrons in Coastal Command absolutely flooded the area every minute of the day at that time. Later on, once we got radar, we could do it at night. But until we got radar, we couldn't do it at night. Radar was called ASV.
Well, we'll come there, because we haven't got it yet. So that was that's a very clear explanation of what the patrols were for.
Yeah.
It wasn't by any means futile. You were doing the job.
Absolutely.
Now, what else were you looking out for? Primarily
it was U-boat patrols. We did from time to time get diverted where aircraft had been shot down, and the crews were in the water in inflatable lifeboats that we all carried, dinghies and things like that, and we would look for them and try and find what we were sent to look for. And then our job then would be to home onto it a destroyer, mainly. We had to take our instructions from control in respect of things like that. We did once or twice come across lifeboats that the control didn't know were there. That's what it amounted to. If they'd known they were there, they would have told us that an aircraft had been shot down in such and such an area. But they obviously, when they were engaged in battle at that moment, weren't able to advise base of what was going off. So we would come across them. Certainly you'd see entries in that book where we did from time to time.
Now, what about, did you ever sight German aircraft, or was that just a threat at this stage?
I didn't at that stage, but
you still kept a lookout for them.
Oh yeah, we certainly did.
Now, how long would you be out for?
Yeah, about 8 hours.
Now that's a long old patrol. They are 7:30, 7:20.
Yeah.
There's lots of.
There won't be many tens.
There's lots of sevens. Up to
8. 7 to 8 hours, yeah.
Was that tiring?
Yes, it would be. You'd be quite weary when you came down after 8 hours flying. It took you 2 to 3 hours to get ready, you see, to fly. So you've got to add that onto your time. It was a pretty long day, really, because then when we came back, we had to be debriefed.
You'd go out, you'd fly the area you'd been told to fly in, and then just come back.
Yeah.
Now, anything about what would the procedure be when you landed?
Well, we were picked up when we landed and taken to the aircrew mess, which was there was a separate mess for aircrews either coming back or going out on patrol. We had a meal. We went and had a meal going out. We had a meal coming back. We used to dine well. There was nothing really rationed to us. You couldn't get eggs and meat and things like that. In civilian life, it was all on coupons, but we had as much as we wanted and needed. We were well cared for in that respect.
Now, what about debriefing?
We'd then go... we would go to ops room and be debriefed first, and then taken to the mess.
Now, what was debriefing?
And the debriefing... Well, the various officers concerned, like the armoury people, would ask us if we'd used any guns, any armament. He would already know, in fact, I would imagine, because if we were going to attack a U-boat, or we saw one, we would radio in. We'd break radio silence for that reason, so... The various officers would debrief us, and the navigation officer wanted to know how the navigation had gone, whether we'd got back, you know, whether we'd got lost or if we'd had any problems. And, you know, we knew at the end of a patrol, we knew what time we were going to land from the calculations we were making. And... if you were 15 minutes late, you'd made the wrong calculations, and they would quiz us to try and find out what had gone wrong. Was it just a mathematical calculation, or was it a physical thing that had gone wrong?
Now, one thing you might have to report is there's quite a few references to engine trouble in the engine. Mm. The Whitley not very reliable.
No.
What sort of engine trouble was that? Much was it?
Well, I remember up in Wick sending out two SOS messages where our engines had cut. And on both those occasions, it was because the pilot hadn't switched the tanks over properly. It was nothing to do with the aircraft. It was just bad flying, really.
That was our friend Perry's fault,
then. Yeah.
But other than that, with the problems?
Well, we did. We had a crash.
Right, we'll come to that separately. I know you've got a big crash. Now, what about convoy escort? What was that like? I mean, we don't need to go through all the things. I presume all
no.
the briefing and everything else.
Well, we yes, that would be part of the briefing.
What was the convoy escort duty like?
Yeah, well, it was a bit tricky. Because the... it's a well-known fact that the Royal Navy shot down more British aircraft than the Germans did. They were very, very touchy, and you can understand why. And the minute we sighted a convoy, it would be my duty to flash off through the window of the aircraft the colours of the day. When we set off, part of the briefing was they'd tell us the colours of the day, that there were, we'll say, red and green cartridges, and we would be given the cartridges, and they were in my care, and when we picked up the convoy, the first thing we did would be to set off the cartridges, and they would acknowledge them with the same cartridge, with the same colours of the day, and so that meant that the convoy had accepted you, and you'd got the right convoy. And we would just fly round and round around the convoy at respectable distances, and keeping an eye open. Whilst we were flying round the convoy, there wasn't really much chance of a U-boat surfacing and firing a torpedo. So they were quite happy, the Navy, that... that the aeroplane above them was guarding them, and they were really safe from any U-boat attack. The only time that they were in danger, of course, was when they hadn't got air cover. So it was up to the powers that be to organise the correct air cover for them. It is a well-known fact that the Royal Navy headquarters and the RAF headquarters were in the same building in London, and it is still to this day that they are both together because of the liaison that that was required between the those two services. When convoys were on patrol, they wanted cover all the way.
Anything happened during a convoy?
Well, on one occasion, yes, but not up in Wick. That was when we went down to David Stowe Moor.
I'm just looking through the thing. There's things about suspected submarines, you know, anti-submarine, you know, lots of this going on. And then we come to, it looks like a crash on the 2nd of April.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That was 1943.
That's when you were on an anti-submarine and you crash landed on
Fuller Island.
Now, can you tell us that whole story? Because I know that's quite a big thing. You know, I've seen, you've got a photograph thing.
A photograph in there, yeah.
Tell us the whole story as you saw it.
Right, well, we were coming back to base. The patrol that we'd been on was up to Iceland, and we'd finished the patrol. We're absolutely bored out of our minds on that particular occasion. And it had been a very, very quiet patrol, and that was the reason for the fact that we were bored and nothing seemed to happen. We ran into bad weather as we were coming alongside the Shetland Islands to Wick. And we went up above the cloud, so we would be probably flying at about 3,000 feet, and suddenly the aircraft started to shudder, and the pilots holding the wheel was going like this. He couldn't hold the wheel at all. The second pilot had a wheel as well, and he took it over with alongside the pilot to help him out, and between them they just could not control the movement from that wheel. In fact, the captain of the plane, Tom Perry, he damaged his back through it, and so he said that they were going to have to ditch in the sea.
Now, what was causing that again? What was causing it?
Well, I forget a lot of the terminology, but you know there's twin tails on a Whitley, and you know the elevators at the back, on the elevators, they've got ailerons, like the ailerons on the main wings, and that is so that when the pilot puts the stick forward, that the elevators at the back either go down or go up according to whether he's put the stick forward or brought it into his stomach backwards. And that aileron is fastened to the elevator with a split pin. The pin goes through, like that, and it's retained. And the retaining pin, to stop it falling out, hadn't been put in properly. And with the 6 hours that we'd been out on patrol, the movement of the aircraft, of the airflow, gradually displaced this pin, and the pin dropped out, and consequently there was nothing to retain the aileron to the elevator. Yeah, on the elevator. And so it was just flapping about in the breeze, as it were, and which was causing all the movement, all the aircraft movement. Now,